I would like to now start on the issues of agriculture, livelihoods, and food security. But really, it's we want to use the term food sovereignty. I should have changed it in my presentation because I fully agree in with the definition, which really look at, you know, self-sufficiency, which look at focus more on food production, domestic food production, and so I would like to really give an overview of agriculture and food production from a gender perspective. We have other presenters, and we want to make sure that the specificity of a country dimensions, regional dimensions, but also are addressed. So I would really, my role is to bring in the role of women in agriculture and food production, look at how macroeconomic policies have been influencing agricultural policies and food policy, and also look at, I will look a little bit on climate change and the impact on food production. And I was asked during our preparation that I should talk about the role of women in agriculture. What are women placed? I tried to use some FAO statistics because I think that would be some really recognized sources, because there's a lot of debate about women's role in agriculture, and some people recognize that, you know, women are more produce 80% of food, others don't. But I think FAO sources would be something that we could all rally around. I just want to give a highlight. In my presentation also, we give a lot of examples in Africa, because this is a region that has been really lagging behind in food production, that has been lagging behind and didn't have agricultural revolution in court like other regions, and highway industrialization also in agriculture has been really not happening. And I don't want to say gender and food, but I want to say women and food, because women are really the food producers, and we will see that women produce the bulk of food consumed, and women are also those that ensure that families have the intake of nutritional level necessary for survival. And women are also work on in different productive activities in agriculture, be it in farm, in gardening, fruits and vegetables, and they also earn an income in agriculture. In sub-Saharan Africa, FAO says that 80% of essential foodstuffs used both for sale and food consumption are produced by women. And Egyptian agricultural labor is produced 50% by women. And in Colombia and Peru, 25 to 40% of work in the agricultural field is undertaken by women. So these are, we also recognize that the question of, you know, women's income and work time, and the question of energy is very important. Energy in terms of distance, in terms of time spent to produce food is very critical. But also resource management, food preparation, collecting food, all of this is related to food, is really, you know, an allocated by women. For example, 90% of women's labor is done in rice cultivation in South Asia. Women also participate in environmental management and agricultural management. In sub-Saharan Africa, for example, 120 different species of plants are crops that are cultivated by women. In the Andean region, especially in Bolivia, Colombia, and Peru, women are also responsible for the conservation of seed banks, which means, you know, really they hold the traditional knowledge of food and food crops. FAO has used the term feminization of agriculture, but also highlighted discrimination against women farmers in accessing and controlling resources, agricultural resources. a fair world. For example, in Malawi, 21.8% there has been an increase in women's activity and women in the women farmers compared to men. This is due, of course, to wars. This is in Africa. This is due to migration. This is due to impact on HIV/AIDS on men, and an increased number of women are now in agriculture compared to men. But FAO also has highlighted the discrimination against women in agriculture in terms of, you know, different compared to their knowledge, their indigenous knowledge, but the discrimination, access to resources, control, and these figures are very telling. For example, 10% of Indian and Nepali women and Thai women own land, only 10%. Only 10% of credits are allocated to women compared to men. There are also other discrimination in regard to extension workers worldwide. Women represent only 15% of agricultural extension workers worldwide. And African rural farm households are less educated, they are younger, they have no access to credit or good land or land title, and training in extension work. So we see really, you know, different situations, different examples that show the different processes of discrimination against women. In the area of unpaid work, we did talk a lot about unpaid work, and women spend not only work in the farm, but also they undertake all the unpaid work in related to rural development. I want to really move on to the question related to agriculture and agricultural policies, because and before going to talking about deforestation, deforestation does have gender dimensions, and deforestation is extremely present in developing countries, especially in Africa. Before we talk about climate change, recently there has been waves of deforestation in different countries. We've heard about the Great Famine in Ethiopia and the drought. We heard about the Sahel in a large band of land in Africa, moving from West Africa up to Central Africa, almost close to Chad. And about 1,300 square kilometers of are deforested every year, and this represents 4 times the size of Belgium. Deforestation also has an impact on humans' ability to gather and collect forest food, especially in the Sahel, where during a large part of the year, when you know what we call period de soudure, the period between the time where they start farming, and they finish really all of the food that was available in the farm. There is a time period where families depend only on gathering and collecting food. And when there is a drought, that means that, you know, a lot of food that used to be available for gathering and collection is no longer available because of deforestation. Deforestation also has a large impact on the pressure on land and women's ability to have land. When the land is become dry and more arid and more inexploitable, and women are given actually part of the land that is not good. We've seen that in several examples in different countries and studies that have been shown. So what are the linkage between economic policies and agriculture, and why do we say that macroeconomic policies do have an impact on agriculture? We've talked all last week about market-driven economic policy, about the way macroeconomic policies is really, you know, favoring markets and export for growth, meaning that macroeconomic policy is also favoring export-led agriculture compared to subsistence farming, where women are most present. So I try to show, first of all, not only macroeconomic policy, but show and give an example of really a process of policy making in Senegal, a number of years, how macroeconomic policies and stabilization policies have really favored not only export agriculture, but also have favored, have excluded women farmers. Macro and policy choices that promote market-oriented expert-led growth do have an impact on support to food production and subsistence farming. In developing countries that have a high dependence on food imports has been really hit by the food crisis because, and this is not an accident why developing countries have been hit by the food crisis, it's because exactly the fact that they have been so for so long increasingly dependent on food imports. Food imports in the form of imports of food, but also food imports in the form of food aid. Food aid have discouraged a lot production at the local level. And because it represents also a market for farmers in developed countries, being the US or Europe, that are able to export their food as food aid. It is not given, it's not free, it is sold to institutional, into like WFP, it is sold to governments that send it to developing countries as aid. But this food also has all of this, if you see it as import in general, has an impact on the ability to produce, the incentives to produce, and the policies that environment in the countries that, you know, create the condition that allow farmers to produce. But also, given countries' dependence on food exports and on food imports, they have been much more hit, hard hit by the food crisis and food crisis that we have seen. And this has been really a big warning by several economists. One of them, René Dumont, has written for many years of the early years of independence about agriculture in Africa and the process of supporting groundnut cultivation, continuing actually the form of agricultural exploitation that was implemented during colonization would really lead to a danger in terms of food production and nutrition and livelihoods in the region. And I may go back, and also I think Mahmoud Lamine Gakou has written The Crisis of African Agriculture, and Samir Amin have written about the global failure in agriculture with what he called maldevelopment, and so many other authors. And I may just flash back to say that agricultural processes, if you read in history, and I always like to read history to see what happened before in the world, what happened in India, what happened, how the economies function in India, in Africa, in Latin America before colonization. And you read, I think Nilufa talked about Ibn Khaldun, but there was a very great also Arab traveler, Ibn Battuta, who had described agricultural organization, administration in West Africa, and shown the amount of food production, the diversity, and the level of nutrition that people had compared to Europe in the 8th up to 12th century. And so we cannot analyze agriculture without analyzing also colonial-led agriculture, how the colonization process, which was an economic endeavor, had reorganized agriculture towards the benefit of France or the UK or the former colonizer. And I know that if you look at Africa, it has been divided into zones. The some of the zone that was producing groundnuts in large quantity coincided with the industrialization in Europe and in France with the need for inputs for soap and oil companies, oil meaning oil for consumption. So they needed groundnuts. So they reoriented the agriculture for people to produce groundnut. And we know that groundnuts is extremely dangerous for the land, because when you produce groundnuts after a year, you need to leave in fallow, or you need to bring millet or beans or other. And it has really contributed in damaging not only the soil, but also in putting the agriculture process in such a direction that was also continued after independence. And that is why René Dumont had written L'Afrique Noire et Mal Partie to kind of stress the damage of colonization and also and the danger of continuing the same agricultural process in that direction. The other issue that is linked to agricultural policies during colonization also is land degradation and lack of investment. There was no investment. It was really trying to exploit for the needs of the colonizers without really investing in infrastructure or productivity of farmers. So contention is that what we're seeing today in terms of the impact of the food crisis in developing countries, in a particular African country, has been a process in the making since colonization, but also through macroeconomic policies. Another fact that is very critical also is water. Not only the certain agricultural techniques and food production techniques have contributed in creating drought, but also the intense tendency towards food privatization we've seen in India, towards also pushing farmers in drier land where there is no water, has been extremely dangerous. And I know that food privatization, water privatization happened more in urban cities, but also in rural areas where there has been privatization in access to, you know, I don't know how to say that, these big wells that are access to forage. There have been also a lot of difficulties for women to farm, to grow vegetables and fruits, and to be able to have access to water. So water is a very big issue, and I didn't insist on that, but I just put that, you know, because I know Mariama talked a lot yesterday about trade issues. The Bretton Woods institutions policy have really created a process of marginalizing agriculture. Not only towards telling people, countries, you have to follow your comparative advantage. If you are an oil producing country, you don't need to invest in agriculture. You need to promote oil and export on oil, discouraging farmers to produce. But also, there have been a determinate effort to really kill subsistence farming. And I tried to just show Senegal, which was the first country in Africa to implement strategic adjustment policies, how all of the different waves of such adjustment policies and stabilization policies have had in them, cut in subsistence agriculture, support on export agriculture, and really undermining domestic food production. In, for example, in 1979, the economic and financial adjustment policy, which was really directed towards neglecting agriculture and supporting the only export agriculture, which was groundnuts. And when we talk about liberalization and rationalization of the parapublic sector, and the agricultural sector was a sector that was really a parapublic because the government was very much in support of, during that period until 1979, of providing subsidies, of providing extension agriculture, which women farmers also were benefiting, not as much as men farmers, but they were benefiting, especially access to seed, etc. This has had a very bad impact on food production. In 1980, also, there was an enhanced adjustment facility that really requested a decrease in public spending in removal of agriculture subsidies, which, again, had an impact on the ability of smallholder farmers and women farmers to produce. In 1981 and 19, so these are waves, different waves of policies that every time the government managed not to implement them because they were unpopular, or the government was not because of pressure by the rural masses or by the workers or by the people, the government didn't completely implement. And another policy intent, another wave of agreement comes, and every time there is insistence from the IFIs, from the IMF and the World Bank to bring in the question of agriculture and promote export-led agriculture at the expense of subsistence farming. So I will not dwell too much on this, but I just wanted to kind of share with you this so that you see that, you know, that this has been really a process of insistence of killing agricultural policies, especially food production. And at the same time, when we know that, this whole debate now on subsidies and how much Europe and the US have been providing subsidies to farmers. We wonder what, I mean, this is really, sometimes I say this is a plot. Because on the one side, in developing countries, there is no possibility of providing subsidies. The subsistence farm and the food crop production is completely undermined, while there is a deliberate effort to encourage countries to export, to import, but also to take food aid, at the same time opening their market to agricultural production that is coming from overseas. So you see a combination of policies in a domestic policy, but also foreign policy in terms of trade agreement, but also in terms of importing food in the country has really had a very negative impact in farmers' support to produce locally. I want to move a little bit to the recent development in food, in the food crisis. And I, you know, I just tried to show here before that, you know, what a country like Nigeria that was really exporting food in a, you know, I mean, have self-sufficient in food, that became a net importer of food and even was not able to import the amount of food necessary for the local demand. And really, you know, this of course has a very large impact on the nutritional impact on communities. I want to dwell a little bit about on climate change and show the link between climate change and food, and because of and also economic policy. You know, industrialization and human activities have been eroding biodiversity and fostering climate change, but also there has been combined with deforestation. But what happened also is that but at the same time there has been an accelerated effort to really promote biofuel, which is crop for fuel, which is how do you use crop that people eat to cultivate it, that, and use land that people are supposed to be cultivating food to produce crop for biofuel, and what it has, what impact it has really on food consumption, and it linked to now the recent food crisis of 2007-2008. What does it mean? What are the linkages between that? We've seen different countries setting up targets for biofuel. The U.S. First of all have said that have set a target of 28.4 billion liters of biofuel to be used for transportation by 2010. The EU also has set targets for biofuel. Brazil, we know, has for a long time been mixing biofuel with diesel oil. But also increasingly developing countries in Africa, China, also Thailand, many developing countries are more and more pushing towards biofuel, including sub-Saharan Africa. And this, I call it crops for fuel, because the rush on biofuel have really raised the demand on food. So this has contributed in the food crisis, in addition to also, of course, increased demand from China, increased demand from India, etc. But the rush towards biofuel also has increased the rice, increased the demand, and of course the price of food. And the World Bank has actually estimated that global food prices have increased 181% overall, you know, because of the food hikes. The U.S. Prices of wheat export also have rose from 375 ton in January to 2008 to 140,000 ton per dollar in March, and this really has contributed in the food hike of food prices. We've seen from Haiti to Senegal to different capital cities in the world, riots on food, and people wonder how come all of a sudden we've seen these food riots. Where did it come from? And some of the factors are really linked to consumption patterns. They're linked to the choices, deliberate choices of trying to support consumption for rich people and for well-to-do people against the large masses of people in the world, of poor people in the world. And this has, of course, a large impact on women as food producer, and also as provider of food in terms of cooking, in terms of making sure that family have good food intake. How am I doing for time? 20. Good. If you look at agriculture, especially in developing countries, we see that there has, given the macroeconomic policies that have been set in place in terms of supporting export agriculture and not supporting food production locally, has really undermined investment in agriculture nationally. And investment in the form of forms of access to fertilizers, access to farm implant, access to knowledge and technology, but especially investment in traditional knowledge. I remember in 15 years ago, I was doing a farming system research, and I was with some people working in forestry, and they were trying to use this Acacia albida. This is a plant that helps that grows all year round because animals it can be used for animal feeding, but also it can be used for shadow. It can be also it's very good for regenerating the soil. And they were trying to teach farmers growing it in this very arid Sahel land in South Mauritania and also in Mali. And one of the things that everywhere we went when we were doing this farming research, we saw that women were saying, your process is not good, we do not agree, let us use our own. And it was finally agreed that, okay, we're going to take a year time and let women lead the forest specialist, forestier, I don't know how to say that in forest specialist to grow the Acacia albida from their own knowledge and their own traditional indigenous knowledge. And after 3-4 years, it was proven that the process that women used and the technique that women used worked better, that the trees grew faster, and the number of leaves that it was given was even much more larger than what was grown by the forestier. So to say that, if you know, investment in indigenous knowledge was something that was given a priority, in addition to of course investment in technology, etc., there would be a different pace to agriculture. And indigenous knowledge, of course, of plants, of medicine, are of course in a knowledge that is held by women because they have been food producers. So I insist in that because everywhere I go, and I go to Guatemala or in Latin America or in Asia, in rural areas, I see that there is so much knowledge in terms of food, how to conserve food, in addition to producing food conservation, that is not tapped into, but that is being patented by other universities and centers of learning globally. That this is something that has been neglected completely. Another area where we need to look at ahead is really even in areas where we say that it's, for example, the Sahel, which we see is a doomed area for agriculture because it is said that there is no water. The Sahel actually has a large wealth of fossil lakes, and it is said that the number of rivers the Sahel has combined together has the same strength than the Nile. So again, it is really extroverted policies that are part of the problem, but not really locally endowed or locally existing agricultural endowment and soil in any given region in the world. Looking ahead, I think that it is important that an agricultural revolution is done. There has been attempt in Latin America, in Asia, even though this has had dramatic implications. We've known a number of suicide by farmers in India because of the green revolution, so-called, which is being attempted in Africa through different institutions, including the Millennium Project that was pushing for a green revolution in Africa. But the way the green revolution was being done, to me, was really going to repeat errors of the past because it was mostly supporting large farmers. It was supporting export agriculture instead of reinvesting in domestic production of food. And this is, and what I would like to suggest is really, as we look forward, there should be three areas three directions that agricultural policy can go. First of all, technological agricultural revolution needs to put priority on the gender-sensitive agricultural revolution with a technological aspect regarding what kind of equipment and inputs, big fertilizer, what is applied knowledge, could improve productivity of food producers and smallholder farmers, including women. Another area is really local economic policy. What options can be taken regarding prices and outcome and income structures? What options can be taken regarding domestic export and agricultural policies? Also, appropriate pattern of financing and credits are important in looking at agricultural policies and from the economic point of view. These are very important elements that combine together if investment in domestic agriculture is then can give very important result, but support not only women farmers, but also smallholder farmers. The large one is a social and political support to agricultural revolution, to look at what kind of rural and social administration where women farmers have a voice and decision-making power. To look at what mode of social administration of agricultural policy and domestic food production can be developed that will be gender-sensitive, but to also look at different groups within rural communities. But also to look at organization of farmers, including leadership of women farmers and food producers. We've seen with the food crisis, women farmers have been at the forefront of all of these riots for water, for food, and we know that their leadership is extremely critical, because when food is missing, when food is expensive, it is women who are farmers, but also women who are managers of household food intake that at the end they have to find means to survive. So I want to take this overview and leave you there and let open for comments, questions, and discussion. Thank you very much.
Okay, so good morning. Thank you, Yesen. Thank you for a really comprehensive and deep overview of this food crisis. I have a lot to say, so I hope you can bear with me for a few minutes. Huh? I don't know if people are aware, but that the world has passed a threshold, a record-breaking threshold, June of this year. And it's not a good threshold. Okay, it's a breakthrough of a sorts. 1.2 billion people. So we have crossed a threshold, have now joined the ranks of the hungry and permanently malnourished. And it is a real tragedy. And I think, Yesen, the point that you made about the role of the Bretton Woods, and that this is not an accidental thing that just happened, but that it was a coordinated strategy. And I would like to quote to you from a paper I wrote the other day on the food crisis. And that's how the discussion about food security and food sovereignty came up, because there was a real tension in the trade discussion. Huh? Because the position of the U.S. has been that there is no need for developing countries to produce their own food, because they can buy that food on the world market. And in fact, the former Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Brock, said that there was no reason, and I could quote, my computer went off, sorry, I was hoping to quote from it, but he said, there is no reason for developing countries to produce their own food when they can buy that food from the global market. And so that's been the sentiment and the policy that's been driving food production. And the policies that the World Bank and the IMF link live. So I want to flag two things. One, the gender implication, and I'll come back to that. But the first thing is that the link between the food crisis and HIV, AIDS, which people have not been talking about. And if you look at World Food Program data and discussion, that the HIV will be rising as a result of lack of food. Because even with people get the antiretrovirals, if they're undernourished, if you're undernourished, you're going to die within 3 months of the of taking the antiretroviral, because it needs well-nourished body for it to work. And there are side effects that comes from people not having adequate dietary intake. So this is not just a matter of policy. It's a matter of life and death that people are going to be dying. Pregnant women with HIV and who will get inadequate nutrition are likely to, so there'll be more mother-to-child transmission of HIV for women who have inadequate nutrition. So only when you have proper nutrition do the drugs have their full impact. There's also some concern that's been voiced by World Food Program, and that actually showed up in Uganda's NAPA. The NAPA is the national assessment that countries make about their climate change. And this was, interestingly enough, the main reference to the Uganda NAPA around gender was, and it's flagged here, that there's an increased transmission of viral infection, HIV rather, between women and girls, young women and girls, who are turning to transactional sex to get food for their mother. In the case of, for their family, in the case of Uganda, it was that men were marrying younger girls, even younger than the normal ages, in order to various cultural things around young girls and sex. 7 out of 10 women suffer from hunger. 45% of them have of anemia, which is linked to malnutrition. They'll be and they're suspected to be increasing rise in maternal death. And already we have 300 women dying daily in the South, and increasing maternal death from this. I think for me, it is very important for us to recognize that up even in the 1990s, food supply, food production was outpacing population growth, even though we know that it started to level off in the 1980s. And so the question is why? What has happened? And everybody says, oh, it's demand condition. But actually, the point that you're making is that this is a structural condition going back to the elimination of subsidies, elimination of credit for marketing board, the elimination of credit and subsidies for storage and transportation that came with the WTO agreement, Uruguay Round Agreement. And previous to that, under structural adjustment, and then carried over into the agreement in agriculture. So you have a tremendous amount of it. If you look at the World Bank loan, the same Office of Evaluation Development of the World Bank argued that World Bank loans for agriculture, which was about $7.7 billion in 1980, has now gone down to $2 billion. So there's a systematic reduction and decline, disinvestment from agriculture in the World Bank programs and the IMF program. At the same time that ODA, Overseas Development Assistance, was also having lessening impact, lessening availability for developing countries. So this is a very systematic result of macroeconomic, social policies, overseas development policies that has led us to this situation, which is having tremendous implications for developing countries. Now, there's this very disingenuous debate going on as to whether or not the financial crisis has led to, has any role in the generation of food crisis. And the IMF put out a report that said, no, it didn't. But in fact, there are now people who are questioning that, and work by IATP and other groups have shown that the IMF actually didn't look at the whole data, and that in fact you could trace the rise in food index. There was a specific that as speculators, as paper assets and stock market assets started falling, investors started doing profit jumping from those into commodity production. And you could look at the rise in food index between the time of 2007, latter part of 2007 up until now. You will see a dramatic association. I can't say cause. People are saying so. Experts are saying cause. I'm saying at this point from the literature. You can see the spike related to the drop in the financial crisis. So there's a whole big debate and a questioning of the legitimacy of the IMF and what they use to generate a result to try to show that there's no link between the rise in food prices from, say, end of 2007 to no. And so that's a big debate going on. So it's something that I think we have to look at, we have to pay very close attention to, and we have to constantly hold people to account. This is criminal. I mean, this is people's livelihood. This is a matter of life and death. And we have institutions who are now putting money in through the global, through the G20 process, right back into the IMF and the World Bank without any structures as to what they're going to do with that money and with any requirement for them to deal with the emergent food crisis. And we're focusing on bailing out the banks and other financial and non-financial cooperation. And if this doesn't make people go up in arms, it certainly makes my blood run cold when I look at this stuff. Sorry for taking up your time. But I do have a paper on it so I could circulate. Thanks.
I will not take long time, but just one sentence to Hers' comments. World Bank, before the financial crisis broke out, requested from the developed countries $500 million for the food crisis, which I think couldn't collect. But after the financial crisis broke out, the U.S. financial package was $900 billion. To compare how much money has been invested in the financial crisis, and so much less money was planned for the food crisis, which I think couldn't even be collected, just to point out this thing.
Thank you for your presentation. When you spoke about food sovereignty, I remember Renia when she said that we don't have to focus on the fact, we have to focus on the process. And when we speak about sovereignty, we know also think about to have food and to produce food. You know? We also care about the way that we produce this food. And that is, for example, in Ecuador, we pushed to put the food sovereignty in the new constitution. And now we have that. But they are still focusing on the fact to have food, and not focusing the way to produce food. And we are now importing many seeds and many fertilizers from other countries. And we are not still sovereignty in our production. So that means that we have to invest in attack seeds that we are using now and produce our own fertilizers in our areas. Another thing is that we are pushing to take back all the traditional products that grow easy in our areas. But the city doesn't know how the way to use that because we lose the know to make this food. And they are very nutritional, but we don't know that. So we have to take care about the other side, the demand, not only to produce, but only to teach people to eat. And another thing is that Nolly for chat yesterday about the categories of the world in our countries. I don't know if it's the same in your country. But the agriculture is like the last category. Even people are ashamed, they say that they are agriculture. And that's another thing that we have to work, is to put this work, the agriculture sector, like the primary sector in our countries. They are giving the energy of the country. Mm-hmm.
I would like to flag up news. A few months back, I saw in newspaper that a huge part of agricultural farmlands in African nations is taken over by foreign private corporates for 99 years of lease. So in this background, how do you tackle the problem of food sovereignty? Second, groundwater table depletion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Yasin. I have a comment followed by a question. Based on, in Jamaica, a lot of what you're saying held resonance for me because some of the dilemmas to do with rural development and agriculture in Jamaica were quite similar to what you were presenting. But my particular interest is in the remaining vestiges of colonialism and the influence in not just agriculture as a sector for development, but also the meaning of agriculture psychologically. In Jamaica, for instance, there's an association of agriculture that, especially with young people, that is slave labor because of the former association of working on plantations. Even though during enslavement, you still had persons who would be doing agricultural work for in ground provisions and so on for their own sustenance, because during slavery, some of the planters refused to actually give them food. So there's that association, which still is somewhere within the culture, that when you are doing agricultural work, it is slave labor, and you want to disassociate yourself from anything that has to do with slavery. The other thing is that while it is still done as subsistence farming in some communities, because there has been a reduction in the government's input in, for instance, agricultural marketing, assisting small farmers in selling their products on the export market, assisting in connecting the different towns, rural towns, to Kingston, so that domestic production or domestic sell, just attending to selling products within the domestic market, fruits, vegetables, and so on. There has been this retreat from agriculture because of that as well, and now even a reliance on imported products. So, for instance, 20 years ago, you would never hear of anything like imported grapefruits in Jamaica. Now, because we had an influx of imported grapefruits, it literally wiped out the grapefruit industry to the point where, and then the correlate to that is that the local marketing, the agricultural marketing structure that the government had in place had closed down, and therefore were not in a position to assist the farmers that they used to assist before in marketing and making sure that their grapes were distributed across the island, spatially or properly, because grapefruits don't last if they're not distributed properly, similar to other products like pineapples and watermelons. It is these three areas, the psychology of agriculture, because of as it was a colonial vestige, two, there's the fact that the governments are no longer putting enough faith and backing that faith with resources in those who choose to gain their livelihoods from agriculture. And three, the fact that there's this dearth of, I guess you could say, a new generation who is no longer interested in moving into agriculture, and therefore, quite frankly, not doing anything. They move to the urban areas and they create more havoc. For instance, Jamaica has a population of just under 3 million. And Kingston has 1 million of that 3 million, right? Which is really too much. So in 10 years, we've had 50% of our urban population grow in just 10 years, right? Because of that absence. And whereas agriculture was about 20-something percent of our GDP, right around independence, it is now less than 5% of our GDP, right? So that gives you an idea of how much it has been affected at many levels, and also because of trade liberalization, because of structural adjustment, all of these various things that have been affecting other developing countries as much as Jamaica's, the emphasis is no longer there. And I still point back to, and I'm rambling for the first time because since I've been here, but it hits at the heart of what is problematic and can also be a cure, I think, if we really get it right. So the question, all right, let me see if I can frame the question now properly since I've rambled enough. The myth of resource insufficiency. That's the title of an article that Louis Lindsay, a mentor of mine, had written in a social science journal in University of West Indies a very long time ago in the 70s. And in this book, the article Myth of Resource Insufficiency, was the idea that former colonial countries did not have enough resources to manage on their own internally, and therefore had to rely on external markets, and therefore or anything that you produced locally was geared externally, and therefore nothing was geared inwards as well as outwards to balance both the domestic and the external markets. And this, what I want to know is how much is this myth of resource insufficiency being sustained by retaining some of the colonial vestiges in the thinking around agriculture and women's participation in agricultural development in Africa. That is it. I think is that clear? Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
Thank you for your presentation. My question is about how the policies on genetic research was affected mainly women, because when this research is linked with the trade, they modify six, and the majority of women, for example, in Peru, has knowledge, traditional knowledge about six, but with this new genetic research, they modify the products and affect the some includes power that women in the communities has in order to knowledge, and the commercial products to trade affect also on incomes, mainly women's.
And then I'll come back to the next one. Yeah, afterwards. Thank you very much, Mariama. Thank you very much, Mariama, for your very insightful and great, contribution on the discussion. I think the discussion on agriculture and food production is so immense and so linked to everything that we talked about since we began this course. You'd really wonder where to tackle it and where to start, because from trade to macro policy to GMO to it's all linked to, really, sovereignty. And I think maybe to define for people the difference between food sovereignty and food security. Food security is really the idea of how do you ensure that there's food in the country. And you can do it by importing food or producing food. But usually, food security suggests that, people in developing countries, if they can import food, it's okay. It doesn't. They don't need to be investing so much in domestic agriculture. But food sovereignty really brings the idea of self-reliance and the idea of really the decision of producing food nationally and what kind of food and what process do you put in place to produce your own food. And also it brings the idea of really supporting local producers, local farmers, and I think there is more and more push for food sovereignty notion and also the right to food, even by the FAO and IFAD. The question of...
Can I just read this quote while you put a point on it?
Yeah.
So this is the Secretary of State, Brock. He says, the idea of developing countries feeding themselves is an anachronism from a bygone era. They should just buy American.
Where they live HIV. And I agree. We can have a... If we enlarge agriculture to bring fishery, we can see another dimension. I've seen in Bondo, in East in Kenya, girls that have told me, I have exchanged sex for fish. And you see, if you know the agreements on fishery between European unions and African countries that have depleted the fishermen, not only catch the fish, these big boats, they catch the nets of the fishermen, local fishermen. What you see today in West Africa young people migrating to Barcelona, to Spain, it is not, it's a link to fishery agreement. Because all of these young people live on the coast, their parents are fishermen, they have been going, and fishermen have always been in West Africa the best to do well-to-do people. They want to have concrete houses compared to farmers. But because of these trade agreements, the fishermen are obliged to go to sea, die, and not have fish. And the young people are unemployed. So what they do, because they know the sea, they know the boat, they get in the boat and they want to go to Europe. And they die in numbers. So all of this film you've seen people call on people, young people trying to go to Spain is linked to the trade agreement, linked to the lack of fish and the desperation that happened in these communities. And so everything is linked to, but you know, I mean, the question of ICE, I always say this is a plot. It is not just a policy, it's a plot. It's a plot of the IFIs to support, to keep developing countries continuously be in a situation of dependence and underdevelopment. It is the same thing that after independence, when you have the Africa-Caribbean-Pacific agreement with the European, continuing, you know, the process of colonization with all of this agreement. It is not really, and we have to understand that, and if we want to analyze policy. The other issue is, of course, HIV and AIDS and the number of people that are dying, the labor, loss of labor in the agriculture, and nothing is being done to link agriculture with fighting against HIV. Not only the importance of food intake when you're taking antiretroviral, but the importance of really linking agriculture to able body that's supposed to be working and that people, that, you know, countries are losing because of HIV. The second point that is linked to the myth of a resource, neocolonial vestige of and how policy is really, you know, link how, you know, young people in the Caribbean are linking agriculture. This is the same thing in Africa, because the peasants and the farmers have always been looked down upon in because of urbanization colonization and all of the form of city development, urban development have been so much linked to the colonizer and to a new form of modernization that be farm activities, agriculture has always been looked down upon. And young people always have a difficulty going back to the farm. Actually, there's a wave of women now that are saying we don't want our daughters to be educated. Because when they get to go to school, they don't want to come to and they have a job. They refuse to come back to the rural areas to work. They stay in the urban city, and there's a lot of prostitution. So I've seen women who have been saying that, what is this education serving when they don't have employment and we lose them? Again, to show the link with, you know, with the fact that, you know, young people are having being very reluctant to go to them, but also the fact that what is there for them to do? There is no support. If there was support for really real support for production and food production, real support for access to market, I mean, everyone in this issue of a global financial crisis is saying, make sure you don't do protectionism. Actually, you know, when we're doing this agreement with when we were doing this paper with, we were organized this one-day session, some of these countries that were partnering with UNIFEM were saying, we want to make sure that we put the word that protectionism should not be promoted. And why? I mean, they have always had protectionist policies, but who is this for? So again, we need to really, you know, link that to the agricultural policies. I think, okay, someone was asking about, given the fact that, you know, Africa has, a lot of drought and what is there for people to invest in agriculture? And I was just giving the area of the Sahel, which is the driest area in Africa that has a lot of water streams that exist. That they even in the Sahel, there is potential for agriculture. Look at Israel. Israel was, is green. You see all of these, not only farm, but all of these tennis, how do you call it? Golf places that are all green. I mean, it requires a concerted effort for government to say, I want to increase investment in agriculture, but agriculture investment is decreasing not only per capita, but in large amount every year, the government stop investing in agriculture while removing subsidies. If we did the reverse, then we will see some results. So I want to go back now to Bola. Koulibaly first. Let's get the fellows for Koulibaly. Sylvia. Tamar has been raising her hand. Then we go to Bola and Rania.
Okay, thank you very much. This has been a very interesting discussion. Actually, in my opinion, there are two things related to, let's say, colonialization or something like that. But also, there is another part that is internally rooted. And right now, I believe that part might be very important too. As far as trade is concerned and colonization is concerned, I remember when I was a PhD student, we have an association of African students. And every year we will invite a very strong economist to come and talk about development in Africa. And we invited someone from IFPRI because food production, international food policy institution, because food production is very important for us in Africa. And then when the guy came over and we talked about food sufficiency, he said, no, this is not actually good. And this is what is stated in, Mariama just said, food production is not actually good for African countries. For you need to buy food. I say, why? This is not good. We have a land. The rain is good. And there are people who are ready to work and have, for food production. The next day, my supervisor called me to write a paper on food production. Is it good for Africa to buy food or to produce food? The idea was I have to show from that paper that it was good for Africa to buy food rather than producing. And believe me, we used very fancy econometric, because I'm very specialized in econometric. This is the best job I can do, econometrics. So we use very fancy econometric method to show you, Africa, you need to buy food rather than producing food. In the end, I say, hell, this thing, I will not publish it. I have a paper. It's good. We can publish it. And it's very good paper, but I didn't publish it. Then when I went back home, at the beginning, I started working with private sector. When I get bored, I went to the university. I get bored, I went to development agency. And then when you talk with government official, and you say we have to, to insist on food production, they will not listen to you, because what they have been told by IMF and by World Bank, you guys need to produce cash food like coffee, cocoa, and sell it. But the story is, it's not even about IMF and World Bank. And this I will say it without them. This story is, most of our product, the traders are not from our countries. The traders come from abroad. And when they buy the coffee, when they buy cocoa or any other product, it have to go through a central bank. Namely, for cocoa and coffee, it goes through the central bank of France. The commission that the central bank will take on cocoa and coffee is almost half of what will come back home. So the issue might not even be World Bank, IMF, and so on. The issue might be effectively, what she was talking about, the rest of the impact of colonialization on our agriculture. And this is very important. If you are a government official and you say, I don't want my coffee or my cocoa to be sold through the central bank, you are dead. And this, I'm not kidding. The Ministry of Finance of my country, Koulibaly Mawodo, when he said, this is a big problem, we don't want to do it anymore. And when he said, we don't want our money to have a fixed parity with the money from France, 1 week later, he was no longer Minister of Finance in Cote d'Ivoire. So there are real issues. And those issues, I mean, are very related to what I will call real politics. Even though we can say many things, even though we can, write interesting research paper, but we need to actually take into consideration real politics. And that real politics thing, when I come to it, I look at most of the African countries, where you have war and so, and all those things. In Cote d'Ivoire, for example, before the war, we did a survey on food insecurity, and we have about 10% of rural households living in food insecurity. After the war, we did again the survey. The preliminary result is about 25%. The increase is huge. And I believe even the percentage there is still, something is still missing. But so the point is, internally, even though we know that there are those problems, related to external shock and so on, but internally, when there is something like that, when there is war, when there is another type of crisis, what happens is most of the real people, and mostly rural women who are really investing a lot in agriculture because they are actually the people, the person who are feeding the families in our countries. Women are feeding the families in our countries. What happened when there is a crisis, a shock like that, the women are very affected. One, they lose their means of production. And second, they cannot feed the families, so they start doing prostitution to get money. And this is very bad what I'm saying. Most of the armed forces in the country, ONUSI, the armed forces from the United Nations and so on, most of them are actually raping and so on. And then they will give the money so that you shut up your mouth, and that's it. And the women need money, so they have nothing to, they have no choice, and they just do it. The national rate of rape in Cote d'Ivoire was about 1% in 2005. Now it is 12%. When we did the survey this year, it's 12%. And that 12% is just because of the war. So the government in the country, we have the war. What is the government actually doing to get, for women, I will say for poor people, but nothing. Why? Because they actually need money from World Bank, from IMF, from those institutions to get things going in the country. So we as researchers, we as social activists and so on, what can we do? And that's my point. What can we really do, knowing of that? What can we do so that we can actually help those vulnerable people to actually have a better life, especially in the rural area? There are some ideas, but what I realize that is most of the effort that we are doing are not very well coordinated, so that most of the initiative, we don't have a payoff from those initiatives. So what can we do really to coordinate most of the initiatives that are going on right now, I mean, in Africa and out of Africa to okay.
Well, this last set of comments was really depressing. Especially in the light of the question I'm about to ask. My question has to do with the issue of biodiversity and the fact that you mentioned women are the ones who grow subsistence crops, which are the crops where really biodiversity lies. And it's from the recent past, it seems to me that now Western agricultural companies such as Monsanto and Cargill, they have been very interested in this particular resource that especially African countries have, and also in South America. And given that women are the ones who are engaged in this resource and the knowledge that they have, I guess my question is, what can we do to utilize this resource to the advantage of developing countries that have it? So in a way, let's say we started with Africa having oil or Venezuela having oil, and maybe we think the developed countries, they took advantage of it. But this time around, maybe we can design some smarter ways of making sure that these countries are not being taken advantage of.
And Monsanto, because Monsanto is part of the GMO problems. I'll come back to that. Rania and...
Okay. We will continue the conversation because we have many sessions that are coming up. But I wanted to have an intervention, I hope you will not mind, on two issues. One is the HIV/AIDS that was mentioned earlier with Mariama, and then Yasin responded to it. And I want to tie in a little bit various discussions that we have been having in terms of gender analysis, macroeconomic modeling, and what Noon was telling us earlier, how you can really torture the econometrics and show whatever you want to show. So, the way that HIV/AIDS has been incorporated in macroeconomic modeling is by looking at the human capital cost. To break it down, for us, it means people die and therefore they are not going to be able to produce. And that represents lost output in the future. Okay, that's it. That is the cost that is being calculated. Three major efforts. One in India. Three major models that exist that everybody is using in the HIV/AIDS literature. Focus on that. And that is really a disgrace. The second point I want to make is that there is an alternative way. You can use social accounting matrix, and you can link up the household production economy with the rest of the economy, and you can show the kinds of substitutions that are taking place. When you have to take care of somebody, you have to reduce the amount of time that you are spending in other activities. But for that, we cannot hallucinate and say women were working before. We don't know. What do we need? We need time use data. We need to know what people were doing before. Now, we don't have the time use data. What do we do? Purposeful surveys. You have a targeted population, because you know your population that has people with HIV/AIDS living in the household. You have small surveys so that the assumptions that you're making are based on some kind of reality. And although with time use, as Valeria said, you cannot remember what you were doing, well, here you can remember actually what you were doing, because what you were doing was yielding either subsistence production or something that the family was surviving on. So even if the data will not be perfect, we can do something to have a better understanding of what is happening. Olagokia Kintola is one of the people that has been doing these very, very small kinds of studies, but then his studies rely on 10 households at a time, because why? Resources are not going into this. To this day, my friends, there is no comprehensive study on time use for households with people living with HIV/AIDS. What are people doing with their households? I have asked in meetings where UN Stats was there. I was with Indira in UNDP recently. Wherever I go, I ask this question. Everybody's saying, well, we don't have the resources. We don't have the resources? Okay. Somebody has to become the driver of this process. Somebody has to yell and scream. Now, there is a model that does something else. We did not have access to all the information. Kijon and myself worked on it, and so did Tontoy. I want to get to the point of food security that we were talking about earlier. When you do this HIV studies, one of the costs that they include is the cost of medicine. They do not costing. We talk about costing exercises. So what are the HIV/AIDS interventions? The HIV/AIDS interventions, the interventions that you have in the Millennium Development Goals, I am afraid to say, have to do with the cost of medicine. How about the cost of delivery of the medicine? Not only the cost of delivery of the medicine, that implies that you have workers that are part and parcel of home-based care. That is the main mechanism of delivery in many sub-Saharan African countries. Not only that, but in addition to that cost, you must have the cost of food security. How do they calculate the cost of food security? None of that is done, but when you bring it up, how do they include it? They say food stamps. That's it. Food stamps. So the government should hand out food stamps. Okay, you hand out food stamps. And where do people go to buy the food that is non-existent? And even if you have the food and there is a process of gaining access to the food, what does that have to do with agricultural production? So how about putting the cost, the real cost? What would be the real cost? I don't want to take up too much time now, but we went through a painstaking process. Was it expensive? We were lucky because we were working with Erwin Friedman, who did all the costing. He's a very good friend by now in South Africa from the Health Trust Institution. He has some, I don't know, 150 researchers working for the organization. And they were very kind, and they loved the project that we were involved in, so they gave us the data. There is a way to do actual costing. We will go through this, I hope, in a few days. I don't know that we will have the time to go through the details. But we have to go back on the drawing board with our MDG friends and tell them that when they are putting all of these costs in there and we say gender has to become part and parcel, this is what we have in mind. You cannot absorb medicine, as Mariama said. You cannot absorb it without food in your stomach. But food in your stomach is not just food. It is food security. And in order to have food security, you must allow sometimes things to happen, like what Malawi did in 2006, that said to the OECD and to Britain in particular, get out of here. I know that you don't want me to be subsidizing fertilizers. That was the only thing that they needed to do, subsidize fertilizers. And Malawi went from being a net importer of food to being a net exporter in how long? 1 year. Net exporter of maize. This is incredible. So what do we have to do? We cannot stay. When we say we are gender-aware economists, and we want to put gender, and that macroeconomic matters, this is what we have in mind. Because if none of this happens, it is girls that get to leave the school. And I hate to say to my best of friends that building latrines in schools for girls is not enough. Because the minute the crisis hits, they will get withdrawn whether you have the latrines or not. So we have to link all of this to macroeconomics. What does that have to do with the IFIs, with monetary policy, with fiscal policy, with fiscal space, with policy space, all of the things that we have been talking about? It's one and the same. You start from the bottom, which is the question of people are dying from HIV/AIDS. We, and I want to tell my friend here that was saying yesterday, why don't we enter this discussion from the beginning? We have the knowledge. The people that I'm referring to are members of GEMIWG. I know that there must be 10 times as many people out there that I'm not even aware of. But I know the people around this table and outside this table that could enter this policy discussion from day one. But we're not invited. When we get invited, it is at the very end of the process, and then we run to put out little fires. But we are not invited from the beginning when we know how to water the plants and how to make them grow and how to provide alternative development strategies. So a lot of people, and I'll end with this, I've taken too much of your time already. A lot of people are telling me, Bola was telling me earlier, there is a frustration here. Because when we first started in 2003 as a GEM network, we were taking stock of what we know. From 2003, GEM IWG has been involved in many, many different projects. Where are we now? It is not that we don't know anymore. We can codify the information very, very easily. It is now that we really have to have a push at the policy front. How do we get there? That is a key preoccupation, I think, in everybody's mind. I see people going like this. So I hope that in addition to the answers that Yasin will give us to all these questions and the next panelists, that we can also pick their brains and see what they think about all of these policy basically issues. Thank you.
Quite brief, because there are other papers. The concerns have been raised around the table. And one or two things are coming out clear for those who are concerned about African agriculture, as it were, or developing country agriculture, that we need what I'll call policy sovereignty beyond food sovereignty, policy sovereignty for countries to be able to make decisions that suit, you know, the interests of their people. Of course, there is a problem of the debt trap and all that, but we do know that some countries are, you know, getting out of the debt trap, and yet they are not able to make decisions that are favorable to their people for some other, you know, reasons, which we know. A lot of it centering around good governance. So there are a lot of issues that tie with this, why we're still at this stage, why we're still talking about indigenous knowledge, yes, but indigenous knowledge to promote agriculture to what level in the scheme of things? The fragility of agriculture will continue to be so as long as we remain, and the IFIs are pushing developing countries to remain at the level of small-scale agriculture, the indigenous knowledge, and so on and so forth. And we will continue to go round and round the problem of food security because our agriculture is being deliberately decimated by external policy. But now we have the AU, we have the African Union that can be a new front for mobilizing African resources, pushing forward African agenda as regarding what is really best for African sovereignty. And again, we talk about, I'm talking about governance. What is the AU doing about this? By the time we now come to gender, we find that the more decimated agriculture is, the more decimated the gender variable will be. And then we were having this discussion yesterday, and drawing from what Rania has also said, how do we bring gender into the centerpiece of the macro economy? That seems to be the problem. Gender always gets relegated to the level of, you know, food security, micro level poverty management, rather than linking it with the drivers of growth. And I think this is where the challenge that Rania has laid before us becomes very valid. There is this new mantra about evidence-based policy making. A lot of countries, I call it a mantra because it's new and everybody's jumping off it. How can we jump on that kind of boat and follow up and do concrete studies that link gender issues, gender contributions, time use, you know, into the macroeconomic framework through engendered SAMs, for instance? I think that one thing that GEM can do is to agree after each session on one or two key thematic issues that must run around all the regions. It will not do us well if we do, of course we will do independent research, but we must agree that some, you know, concrete particular kinds of research, evidence gender evidence is required all around. And then we take it as a theme that all the regions take away with a coordinated effort to come out with concrete evidence about gender relevance, about gender, the need for gender inclusion, about the implication of gender time use and all that. So I think that we have the leeway to strengthen our output from here and use it, you know, to influence the process. Most importantly, I think that we're beginning to see a new wave of colonialism. The same powers that are telling us to not to produce food and to reinforce small-scale agriculture are coming back into our countries. I know that in my country, Chinese farmers are back, you know, like a horde in commercial agriculture, really large-scale agriculture, taking up land from the farmers. But because of low resource access, farmers are giving out their land. In another 10 years, we'll begin to, you know, worry about a different kind of problem. We have ceded our resources to foreign interests. So I think individual countries need their policy sovereignty. That is important. And how do we get out of the trap of being linked to the IFIs? Well, again, it depends on the level of governance. How can each country get itself out of that trap? And then overall, how can regional bodies like the AU come in and strengthen real African perspective in the way that will really serve the best interests of Africa on the long run? Thank you.
I just want to say a few points, maybe. Short, yeah. Yeah, I'll just speak, say a few words, you know. I want to, first of all, going back to my brother Koulibaly, who was talking about the markets, you know, the intermediaries that buy the food crops from farmers and go to the central bank of France. And he started by saying that we shouldn't talk about colonization because this is present. But hello, my brothers, it's about colonization because until now, the 16 African countries are under French economic colonization because they depend on the franc CFA. All of the reserve, I said that the other day, of these countries are put in the Bank of France, which is now part of the euro, mind you, but we are still having the franc CFA, and we are not able to get away from this. Even the little Gambia has its own money. So these people buy these crops and go to the deposit in the Bank of France, take 50%, it goes. This is colonization big time, new colonization in an even more shrewded form. So I think we should not delinquent that from this powerful. And why is it that the government, the Minister of Finance, is fired automatically after he said that? Because the French president called the president of Cote d'Ivoire and said, look, you have a very naughty, disturbing Minister of Finance. I don't want to see him anywhere else in any meeting. And when you are going to sit with the IMF and to discuss at the Club de Paris about your track record, we will not support you. That's how it goes. So I think that it's about power, but it's about also relations between countries. I think the food, we cannot talk about agriculture without talking about crisis, and I'm glad you brought that. I was in 1995 in Eastern DRC, in Goma, Bukavu, in this huge refugee camp after the Rwanda genocide, trying to assess nutrition level and food security. And what I saw was just appalling. Because the food distribution, my role was to redesign a food distribution system that will enable women to have access to the food, that will enable elderly people, children, head of household, to have access to the food. And what I saw was men who were strong, because they did a small video for Beijing, actually, with WFP called Women Eat Last, which was an 8-minute video that I did from that refugee camp. Because what we saw was able-bodied men could push women, line up, get their food ration, because they have nothing to do in the refugee camp. There is no power. They completely disempower. Go buy beer with the money. Don't take it to the family. And then violence. So we sat with women, and I said, let's use your indigenous knowledge, going back to what. And what can you do so that you can take the money that these men are collecting in your? And women say, you know, we can make beer ourselves. And we can make a kind of beer that men can come buy from us, but it doesn't make them too drunk to be violent. And they made beer out of banana.
to tell you that, you know, using local knowledge sometimes is very important for situations in Africa. The second point is the issue of GMO. I think this is a complete course about genetically modified organisms and Monsanto. And I link that to Malawi, because I was involved in the Millennium Project as for UNIFEM, and I was in Africa for almost a year looking at the setting of these Millennium Villages. And I would like Jem or some of us in Africa to go to Malawi and to see what kind of production has been done in them. Because what I know is that one time I was sent a private email by a woman who was working at the Millennium Village telling me, Yasin, you need to help us. Monsanto is here in a very hidden way. They are promoting GMO. The crops are high and big below, and people are exporting in 1 year. So I see that people are citing a lot about the Malawi case, that over 1 year Malawi has been able to produce and export. I think we need to find a way and to know what Monsanto has done, because I know that Monsanto was present in all of these meetings. They were flying people with tickets. They were bringing nationally Kenyans, Malawians, Africans to represent them in these meetings when they were trying to induce genetically modified organism, which is going to be the killing. I mean, really, le coup de grâce, like people say in French, for African agriculture. The second thing, so I don't know what happened in Malawi, but I think it would be interesting to know what kind of, you know, agricultural system was used, and was it GMO or not. The other thing about HIV and AIDS, I am going to bring tomorrow, I have been working on a 15-minute film on gender, macroeconomics, gender, and HIV and AIDS. It's a 15-minute video that I would bring tomorrow evening, even though we have not shown it all over UNIFEM, but I think it's okay to show it for you to see it, and see how we have been trying to bring these dimensions. Especially now that even in the UN system, there is a more and more effort to say that homosexuality and is should be a dimension that is above gender and women and men issue. And a lot of people are very concerned and worried about it. And I think that we need to be big to show that the cost women affected, I'm not even saying infected, affected by HIV and AIDS, pay to this pandemic, from food security to access to water to unpaid work to losing employment because they're caring for someone, et cetera, is just tremendous. So I think I would like to share that with you. I think I have, okay. I think we need, in responses, we need, I keep saying we need indigenous. And let me tell you why. When the World Bank was putting the barrage of Manantali in between Senegal, Mali, and Mauritania, all of the communities had meetings, including me at the forefront. This was 20 years ago when I used to go on vacation in the north when I was 30 years ago, and saying we don't want this barrage because we know. What is knowledge, indigenous knowledge? It's about lived experiences. Lived experience in how you farm, what you know, and knowing what is in, what are the challenges, and knowing to handle and take care of issues and crises when they come. And they did not want to listen. They brought another barrage in the northern Senegal, between Senegal and Mauritania, a barrage where you used to have river seal. I used to remember, I used to go there, I used to watch river seal on the bank of the river. They died. All of the biodiversity is gone. But not only that, all of the river is full now with a new grass that people cannot, that brings high level of malaria. So again, to show that knowledge, traditional, indigenous knowledge is very key, even for large investment of industrialization. I want to close there. Thank you very much for your participation. It was very much.